This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we'll try and get to the bottom of what's really going on with the charges that have been brought against 16 Americans who work for various NGOs in Egypt. Are the International Republican Institute and the National Democratic Institute really trying to bring democracy to Egypt? Should they be there at all? And what is Egypt doing to democracy activists?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Over the last few years, we here at Law and Disorder have been following the cases of three alleged suicides at Guantanamo, alleged suicides that took place in June of 2006. There's been a lot of controversy about these alleged suicides. There's been many claims that they were not suicides at all, but that the three detainees were in the process of being interrogated or tortured, and that suicides don't make any sense. Supposedly, the alleged suicides took place by means of hanging. But a recent movie that I saw when I was in Norway called Death in Camp Delta raised serious questions about whether these three men could have committed suicide, all roughly at the same time, all by hanging in their cells, and somehow could have not been seen by the guards or the video cameras that operate apparently every 30 seconds or so. So there's a lot of suspicions. As a result of those suspicions, the Center for Constitutional Rights brought a case in U.S. court on behalf of two of the families of those who died at Guantanamo. The case was brought in the District Court for the District of Columbia. The initial case was dismissed, and then new evidence surfaced about a U.S. soldier or guard who saw suspicious activity going on the night of the alleged suicides. The Center for Constitutional Rights put that new evidence in. The district court still denied a hearing on the deaths. And so the Center for Constitutional Rights appealed to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. Of course, that court, particularly with regard to Guantanamo, is notoriously bad. It never affirms almost anything positive for Guantanamo detainees. And if there's ever anything good for a Guantanamo detainee, such as ordering his release, they reverse it. So it's a bad court, but you have to go there. That's where the case is. That's where the case had to be brought. And in an awful ruling last week, three judges of that court said that the case could not proceed, that the court said it had no jurisdiction to hear the case of these men, allegedly suicides, but much more likely killings or murders. And the court said it had no jurisdiction to hear the case because of an act that we brought you much news about, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with in its broad outlines, the Military Commissions Act, passed by Congress, which was an effort to limit the rights of people at Guantanamo to go into courts. Now, the Supreme Court had said that part of that act was unconstitutional, that the Congress could not limit the right of people to go into court to test their detention, but it didn't say much else about the act. And when it went up to the D.C. Circuit, in our case, challenging the Guantanamo deaths, the court said, well, we find that the act is constitutional, the Military Commission Act, and that it bars a lawsuit by the families of those who were killed at Guantanamo. So there you have it, an incredibly awful ruling in which three people, three Guantanamo detainees who died at Guantanamo, in very suspicious circumstances, circumstances which now would indicate that they were killed in some fashion, is not allowed to go into an American court. It's a legal, political, and moral outrage. We also want to bring to your attention two recent Supreme Court developments. As I'm sure most of you know, the Supreme Court is not exactly on the liberal side these days. Well, one of the developments is that after 9 years, they're revisiting, and it can't be a good revisiting, the question of affirmative action in public college admissions. 9 years ago, in a case called Grutter v. Bollinger, the court ruled that the University of Michigan Law School could use race as one of the factors in helping achieve racial diversity in that public university. They said you couldn't use a quota, but that race could be used to increase diversity. Well, now a case comes to them concerning the freshman class at the University of Texas, Austin. And of course, they didn't have to take review of the case, but they took review. And it's a most likely a very bad sign for the use of race as a factor in admissions and for continuing to diversify our universities. Most people agree that without being able to use race as a factor, our public universities will have decreasing enrollments of African Americans and Latinos, increasing enrollments of whites and Asians. So the case is very important. Unfortunately, as I said, the court took the case. They could have left the things the same, but they didn't. And they took the case, and the key is that when they decided the case 9 years ago, you had Justice O'Connor on the court. Not that she was any great liberal, but she actually wrote the opinion in Grutter v. Bollinger 9 years ago. She has been replaced by Justice Alito, whose hostility to affirmative action is open, notorious, and public. That decision 9 years ago was 5-4 in favor of being able to use race as a factor in admissions to public universities. Well, the case will be argued in the fall next year. The court has obviously gotten more conservative. O'Connor is gone, as I said. Alito is there. And so I am not hopeful for what will happen in the fall to affirmative action and the necessity that we still need to have affirmative action in this country. You know, I'm not an expert in some ways about it, but if we think about the history, particularly of African Americans in this country, and you think of three generations of African Americans, or three periods, the period of slavery ending in 1865, then the period of what they call slavery by another name, the Jim Crow laws, when people were, you know, discriminated against really through the 60s based on actual legal segregation, as well as slavery continuing, except slavery by another name, when people got arrested and sold out really to corporations and others to work essentially as bondsmen or workers that were equivalent to slaves. That went through the Second World War and, of course, Jim Crow through the 60s. And now we have, as we brought to you on this show, the new Jim Crow, where a variety of laws have really imposed the equivalent of the black codes on many African Americans. So that the idea the court would think that somehow they don't need to continue affirmative action, we hope is wrong, but it would be outrageous if they don't. In fact, in the decision 9 years ago in Grutter v. Bollinger, the court said that they would continue allowing the use of race as one of the factors for a period of 25 years. So that means it still has 15 years to run, and now you see this conservative Supreme Court sticking its hands back into an issue that should have been at rest for another 14 years. This last week saw a special anniversary of importance not only to progressive politics in the United States, but of particular importance to your three co-hosts, myself, Michael Ratner, Michael Smith, and Heidi Boghossian, the director of the National Lawyers Guild. The Guild, on February 20th, 2012, turned 75 years old. It was founded in Washington, D.C. in 1937, 600 advocates from around the country dedicated to a common cause. That cause was particularly around economic rights, Social Security, support of the New Deal, support of Roosevelt. And in fact, a number of the Guild people worked within the Roosevelt government. It was, after all, the depths of the Great Depression in 1937. There was growing fascism abroad, and the Guild, made up of a variety of lawyers from around the country, was an assertion of hope in uncertain times. For the three of us who are hosts, it was really the foundation on which our careers were built. When I was at Columbia in 1968 and hundreds were arrested, it was Guild lawyers in 1968 who came forward and not only represented those who'd been arrested, but who also taught us young lawyers at Columbia Law School or young law students how to be political, active, aggressive lawyers. The Guild still plays that role today, all over the country, all over the country, and all over the world. So again, thank you, and we celebrate 75 years of survival of the National Lawyers Guild, a survival that wasn't always easy. In the 1950s, the Guild was decimated by the McCarthy era. An organization that had thousands was reduced to something like 400 or 500. It then, as the new left went forward, progressed and progressed, and again built itself up to the thousands of fighting lawyers, law students, and jailhouse lawyers that today represent this important organization. Happy birthday, National Lawyers Guild. Last week, we brought you an interview with Elbin Perez of the Coalition for Immokalee Workers. Elbin described the demonstrations and protests that will be happening from March 5th to March 10th at Publix headquarters in Lakeland, Florida. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers, the people who pick a large majority of our tomatoes in this country, are demanding an end to abuse in the fields and a penny a pound more. They've already won against fast food chains. They've won against Trader Joe's and Whole Foods. And their next target is Publix headquarters. They will be fasting. Workers and others in their support will be fasting in front of Publix headquarters in Lakeland, Florida. They invite all of you, listeners and others, to come to Lakeland, Florida. The fast will end on Saturday, March 10th. You should be there if you can. If you can't be there, go to the Coalition for Immokalee Workers website, ciw-online.org, and give them your support in whatever way you can. We especially want to thank our local station in Florida, WSLR-FM 96.5, that carries Law and Disorder and will be broadcasting this appeal to listeners in Sarasota regarding the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Thank you, WSLR. Recently, the news, particularly here in New York, but really around the whole country, is filled with stories and anecdotes and statements of Archbishop, or at least formerly Archbishop of New York, Timothy M. Dolan, who has just been elevated to the position of cardinal in New York. I mean, you can't pick up a newspaper without seeing pictures of Cardinal Dolan everywhere. And what's interesting about Cardinal Dolan, of course, is he was formerly the Archbishop of Milwaukee. And that is a place in which he was implicated in some of the sexual scandals, or at least of not handling them right, some of the scandals around sexual abuse within the Catholic Church. And the Center for Constitutional Rights represents a group called SNAP, which is the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. And the center has brought a case at the International Criminal Court against both the Pope as well as the Committee for the Doctrine of the Propagation of the Faith, the former Inquisitor's Office at the Vatican, saying they should be implicated in the criminal violations of law by protecting abusers throughout the world, failing to report them to the police or the authorities, moving them around, allowing the abuse to continue. So the question now is, what about Cardinal Dolan? Well, the center issued a press release about Cardinal Dolan, but of course, in all of the wall-to-wall coverage, nothing was mentioned about his role in sexual abuse scandals. But let me just give you a couple of examples. Among the documents the center submitted to the International Criminal Court were letters between Dolan and then Cardinal Ratzinger, who of course is now the Pope, concerning a man named Father Franklin Becker. Becker was diagnosed as a pedophile as early as 1983, when serving where? Well, in Milwaukee, where Cardinal Dolan was. And though the Archdiocese of Milwaukee knew so, he continued to re-offend. Becker was nonetheless allowed to continue to work in several parishes. It was only when Becker was arrested in California in 2003 for sexual assault of a child that Dolan finally wrote to Ratzinger requesting that Becker be defrocked. Ratzinger's office replied that Dolan should inquire whether Becker would voluntarily request his own defrocking rather than be involuntarily defrocked by the Vatican. One case. Another example is evidenced by the case of prominent Harlem pastor Wallace A. Harris. In 2010, Harris, who had been accused of sexually assaulting more than 10 boys, was allowed to step down under a false pretense. Dolan, who by this time was already Archbishop of New York, quietly let him do so without informing the authorities or warning parishioners. More than a year and a half after the fact, the Vatican admonished him to live, that is, admonished Harris to live, quote, a life of prayer and penance. Due to the statute of limitations in New York, Harris has avoided criminal charges. So this is our new cardinal. This is our former archbishop, Milwaukee and New York. And this is who the papers bend over backwards. You could say, except I don't want to be disrespectful, you could say they genuflect to this cardinal. In the last few weeks, the military-backed Egyptian government has targeted the National Democratic Institute, the International Republican Institute, Freedom House, and other U.S. government-funded groups working in Egypt. It has also targeted other NGOs, both within Egypt and from around the world. As part of its crackdown, the Egyptian authorities raided the offices of some of these organizations and brought charges against at least 16 U.S. citizens, six of whom remain in Egypt. Three of them, including the son of the U.S. Transportation Secretary, Sam LaHood, have taken refuge in the U.S. Embassy. Their cases have been referred to criminal courts in Egypt. Recently, Egypt refused to back down despite threats to cut the U.S. $1.3 billion in aid to Egypt. Now, the question a lot of us have is, what's going on here? What is the National Democratic Institute? What is the International Republican Institute? Why are these organizations working in Egypt? Why do organizations that have close affiliations with the Republican and Democratic parties work in Egypt, particularly now that Egypt is going through its own democratic revolution? To help us understand more about the National Democratic Institute and the International Republican Institute, we will talk to Professor Paul Sullivan, a professor of economics at the National Defense University with wide experience in the Middle East and particularly Egypt. Professor Sullivan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Yes, I suppose it would be good morning to the folks listening in, right?
We've all been reading a lot in the papers almost every day about what's going on in Egypt, but particularly with a series of charges that have been brought by some part of the Egyptian government, I guess the Justice Department, Ministry of Justice, against, I think, 16 Americans, some Egyptians, some Serbs, some Germans. Can you just give us a sense of what's going on there with these charges and the institutes, particularly the Americans we're working for, what those are?
Yeah, it's National Democratic Institute, the equivalent of the Republican Institute, represented by leadership on their boards. Let's say John McCain is for the IRI, and Andy I is Madeleine Albright on the board. So you obviously see there's a degree of political connection there. They're funded by the U.S. government to a great extent. Most of what they were given as required duties in countries overseas is to train people on what exactly voting is, what is democratic development, and so forth. So one of the charges that have been levied against them include paying certain political parties, and of course both of these groups deny it, and Freedom House, the third one involved with this, also denies it. There are certain charges that neither the IRI nor the NDI deny, but there's a complexity to that because this environment in Egypt is more fluid, I suppose you might say, than legal environments in this country. The emotions are very high. The issues are becoming more hardened on both sides, but essentially these NGOs are not registered in the country. There was an NGO law in 2002 which required that they're registered. These NGOs state that they did put in all the documentation for registration and never really get an answer back. So they just assumed everything was going well and they continued on with their efforts. They are also unlicensed. That is also true, it seems, and I don't think anyone's denying that. The foreigners in these NGOs are also working without work visas.
Right, so there's a bunch of technical sort of, not technical, but violations of sorts.
Well, yes, when you put in your documentation and you don't get a response from the government and assume that the government gives you a go-ahead with this, I think there's a judgment issue here on the part of some of the leadership in these groups, particularly after the revolution started, is why they should continue doing this. Things got very testy, very complicated. When I was working in Egypt, and I was there from 1993 to 1999, working at the American University in Cairo as a professor, every single year I had to get a work visa and a work permit.
That's interesting.
And there's no way I could have stayed there and working at the American University without it.
You know, it's interesting to me. It brings to mind, you know, there is an American analogous Foreign Registration Act. If you're here on behalf of another government in the United States, you have to register with some organization within the government. And you can, and they occasionally do prosecute people for failure to register.
There was an article recently about whether this sort of action could occur in the United States, and you're a lawyer, and if you know about these laws, it's probably problematic to be here without a work permit and without the proper visas and right. so forth. So we have to be fair to that extent. And also, Egypt is a country that just went through the beginnings of a revolution. I don't think this revolution is over yet, and it may not have even fully started yet, but that's another issue. And then people are looking at their country as newly free to some extent, and they don't want people messing about with them.
No, that's interesting to me. I mean, you said something intriguing when you said when Mubarak was there, these organizations were there. And, of course, that's one situation. But as it opened up, quote, revolution began, it might have been a different kind of choice. And can you just expand on that a little bit?
Well, when Mubarak was in charge, these organizations were sort of a wink and a nod allowed to be in the country. Everyone knew what they were doing pretty much and what their responsibilities were and that they were funded by the government. Again, sort of a wink and a nod. But as the revolution proceeded and new leadership came about and tensions began, it looked like they were looked at differently. And there also seems to be a general crackdown on non-governmental organizations coming. There's a new law for NGOs about to go through the Egyptian parliament, which is much stricter than the 2002 law that they're trying to apply to this case. It's much more restrictive, much more difficult, and some of the NGOs that had nothing to do with anything political are now having a difficult time from even the people on the streets of Egypt. There are good NGOs helping people with health and education and so forth, and this situation is really ratcheting up tensions even for them.
Mubarak was overthrown. There was this whole democratic upsurge, and the military still has a lot of power. So it seems to me that someone like me sitting out here is in an odd place, because in some way, yes, you want democracy there, and yet some faction of the Egyptian government is going after these groups. I'm trying to put this in a political context at all, which I can't understand.
Well, part of the political context is that, indeed, it seems that these organizations were unlicensed, not registered, and working with the wrong visas, which gave ammunition for anyone who wanted to build a base in the New Egypt by going after an American organization or American organizations. There always has been a certain degree of anti-Americanism in Egypt, and clearly since the revolution it's been stoked by certain groups. And this may be, in part, sort of maneuvering for the politics and the power of the future as well. There are lots of streams going on here. But when anything like this happens in any country, it's usually not just because of one objective.
Yeah, it's hard to get a sense from just reading the papers here. But the one thing that strikes me is, you know, the Egyptian military is a huge aid recipient from the United States. You may know the number. It's $1.2 billion or more. I don't recall.
It's $1.3 billion. It used to be greater than that. And this is attached with the Camp David Treaty, which
right.
makes it even more complicated. Because if we take that money away because of this situation, which may ratchet up the tensions between the two countries even further, then the Muslim Brotherhood, at least part of the Muslim Brotherhood, there are many different factions within the Brotherhood. Let's say the more right-wing part of the Muslim Brotherhood says they'll bring the Camp David Accord to a referendum in the country. I can tell you from my near 20 years experience in Egypt that it's unlikely that a referendum would have a very large percentage voting for it.
Right, because the reaction of the U.S., I would say, I mean, in some way it's been mild to this. I mean, here you have our Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood's son, is actually being charged, Sam LaHood. He's taken refuge in the U.S. Embassy. And McCain went over and, you know, even his statements are, let's see if we can work this out and all that kind of stuff. I mean, would you say as well that it's been relatively mild for a complex reason, perhaps?
Well, I would go even further. That has to be toned down much more. The longer that this goes on, and the more the tensions arise, and the more this is a trial by the media, the more likely this will not be resolved, and the longer those people will be on our embassy, and the harder life will be for other NGOs in Egypt. This, in many ways, is a turning point case, or could be a turning point case, for our relations with Egypt. And we have to behave in a delicate, diplomatic, thoughtful, and above all, quiet manner about this.
I mean, you said when we began this that you thought attitudes might be hardening. What does that really mean in terms of the future?
Well, what it means is this is starting to stoke anti-Egyptian sentiment on the Hill and even amongst the American public, many of whom don't understand Egypt as people who have lived there, such as I understand Egypt and the people of Egypt, who are really quite wonderful people, quite warm-hearted and welcoming. But the viewpoint that's being presented here, focusing in on this case, is that there are harsh people, and that is not the case. In the same direction, in Egypt, anti-Americanism is being stoked and hardened amongst mostly the uneducated people, which is actually the great mass of Egyptians. And opinions on both sides for the people, which is very, very important, are beginning to change about each other. I don't think a whole lot of people actually thought about Egypt before the revolution in the U.S. And right now, I guess their initial opinion about Egypt and the revolution is, wow, look at this. They're looking for their freedom and democracy. And now they might be thinking, well, they've arrested American kids. We have the Congress hardening, and we have their parliament, now mostly the Brotherhood and the Salafis, which is another issue about the weakness of IRI and NDI and Freedom House in Egypt. Then essentially, the Egyptians are going after the transparent money, which is the NDI, the IRI, and the Freedom House money.
And that's mostly funded by the U.S., right?
Yeah, yes, it was up front.
Right.
Everyone knew that it was being funded by the U.S.
You look anywhere, you see that. It's public.
But at the same time, there are allegations. And of course, there are lots of allegations and rumors about this, and trying to divine out what's rumor and what's reality can be very complex in Washington, never mind in Cairo, of tens of millions coming in from the Gulf for the Brotherhood and the Salafis. But you don't see anyone going after that right now, because that's mostly opaque.
Now, do you think there's some kind of a deal here where IRI, the Republic Institute, NDI, and maybe Freedom House just stop working in Egypt for a period of time?
I really don't know what the deal will be struck. I would hope that this is done quickly and quietly. I'm sure a lot of people here would be upset if NDI and IRI and Freedom House and others were shut down. This also includes a Norwegian group, and people usually don't think of the Norwegians as people messing about in the politics of others, and it's certainly not the case. But there could be a chance that such organizations will be severely restricted in the future.
Right. Let me ask you this. Something about the history, because I don't think any of us. I mean, I vaguely remember when these NDI and IRI were set up in 1983 or so. Can you tell us why they were set up? What was their purpose? What went on then?
Actually, it goes back to the time of Reagan with the National Endowment for Democracy and other organizations to help spread democracy throughout the world. It was kind of a U.S. goal. And these organizations sprang out of the National Endowment of Democracy later on. They have been involved in many countries in training people about what elections are and so forth. And again, there are all kinds of allegations and rumors about, let's say, ancillary activities that they may have been involved in. I know nothing about that, and I usually don't take rumors at face value. And you being a lawyer, and if there are any lawyers in the audience listening to this, allegations are allegations. They're not truth.
Yeah, you know, I understand that. I've read a number of the allegations, particularly around, I guess, Haiti, Venezuela, and some other places.
Yeah.
But let me ask, I remember I was friendly with a congressman at the time in 83, Congressman George Crockett, who was on the, you know, political liberal to left side of Congress, Detroit congressman. And I remember he wrote me a note when they were setting the National Endowment for Democracy up. And he said to me, Michael, you know, is this really legal to set up an organization that Congress actually funds? Political parties. It's always intrigued me that Congress could decide to fund what are essentially parts of two political parties. And what about other political parties? What about all whatever I ask myself about that?
Well, I'm neither a Republican nor a Democrat, but the idea of exporting Republicanism and Democratic ideology overseas seems somewhat difficult, to put it kindly.
Well, that's interesting to hear. I thought about it in another context. I thought, what if, you know, we have a winner-take-all electoral system, and a lot of countries have a system where every party gets its percentage in their...
I see where you're saying. In Egypt, it's a parliamentary system.
Right.
But the presidential election is given a great deal of weight, and actually, I think expectations are way too high on this. But I think your question goes to an even bigger issue. Should the United States be involved in the politics of other countries to such a great extent?
Yes.
Particularly countries trying to change to a different system, and possibly with political parties that we really don't understand. Many of our officials haven't a clue what the Brotherhood is all about. The Salafis, I think that's pretty clear. But the Brotherhood is a very complex organization. My sense is, and I've said this many times in public, if the United States is going to give aid to countries such as Egypt, it's much more important to build friendships and to build relations, to help them get jobs, investment, education, and human development, and leave the politics to the country.
Is there a place that if people want to read more of what you've written, what you've said, or any last words you have on this whole situation, I'd appreciate it.
Well, I suppose if they Googled my name and National Defense University in Georgetown and just about any country in the Middle East, North Africa, and actually parts of East Africa, they probably come up with a lot of the things that I've written and said. And I gave a talk on this issue on, of all places, Chinese National Radio recently for about an hour with an Egyptian reporter and a Chinese scholar. And at the Center for National Policy downtown, the transcript and the audio would be available there. We discussed this issue. It's a very complicated issue.
It is complicated, but it's also refreshing to hear your thoughts about it, because you just don't read about what you're saying at all. So thank you very much.
Well, Egypt is a far country, not just geographically to most Americans. I think it's a wonderful country, and I've learned to love the people of Egypt. They're just an amazing people. And you'll see that that quality of the Egyptian people come out in the future. Right now, they're having a difficult time.
Professor Sullivan, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Our next guest on this issue of the Egyptian crackdown on NGOs, and particularly NDI and IRI, is Sally Sammy, speaking to us from Cairo. She's a human rights activist and formerly the executive director of the Cairo Center for Human Rights Studies. Sally Sammy will give us another perspective, particularly one focusing on the broad crackdown on democratic groups within Egypt. Sally Sammy, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hello, thank you.
We're speaking to you in Egypt, and we've seen a lot in the United States over the crackdown on various NGOs from the United States, from other countries, from Germany, from Norway, etc. And, you know, some of those obviously have been concerned for us for a long time within the United States. I mean, the NDI, the IRI, Freedom House have a sort of, you know, interesting mixed reputation in the United States. I don't think any of us have a sense of the context in which they're happening, that's what's happening in Egypt, and what your thoughts are about that.
Generally speaking, we're talking about a moment or a time in Egypt when the essence of the revolution itself is being stolen. So we see revolutionaries being arrested or attacked or harassed. We see campaigns against the key outspoken political activists or human rights activists. So this crackdown on civil society in general in Egypt comes within this environment. It's not isolated from this at all. The human rights movement in Egypt played a very important role. It imposed a human rights agenda to the revolution in many ways. On the 25th of January 2011, people went down to demand human rights. So it seems like we're being punished for taking the stance, for continuing to be outspoken about the violations that are taking place, even after the revolution, which is becoming more and more apparent to be worse than what it was before the revolution.
No, I know certainly from our distance in the United States, we watch with tremendous concern because this revolution, which we all had so much hope in and still do, we see the military is still jailing people, is still torturing people.
Exactly.
So give us that context a little bit, and then we'll go to these particular groups.
Yeah, we've seen from the 11th of February onwards an escalation in the kind of attacks against any manifestation of demands, peaceful demands. We've seen peaceful protests being attacked. We saw one of the worst ones was during a Christian protest in front of Nispero when people were killed en masse. We've seen this becoming more and more frequent. Most recently, close to the Ministry of Interior. We previously also at the cabinet, in the street in front of the cabinet, and before also with the Ministry of Interior again when they attacked peaceful protesters who were sitting in Tahrir Square, a very small amount of people who were not even blocking the traffic. So basically we're seeing an escalation of this, but we're also seeing a strong use of state-owned media to tarnish the reputation of revolutionaries and people who are demanding their rights. They're always represented as standing against the economic progress and economic, for the economy to get back on its feet again. They're always represented as thugs, and they're always compared with the nice, cute ones who went down on the 25th of January in the 2011. So the 25th January 2011, those who went down were cute and beautiful and peaceful, but anyone else who is demanding their rights is not, and there are thugs or thieves, people who are attacking, burning buildings, which is not the case at all. There is strong evidence that shows otherwise, and we've seen strong evidence that shows that actually the security forces not doing enough to protect buildings in Egypt from thugs who are there, whether nobody knows. It is a continuous denial of taking the responsibility to protect the lives of Egyptians.
It's really alarming for us to read this here. And one question I have to you, and then I want to talk about NDI a little bit. This obviously has to be solved by the people of Egypt. But in terms of what kind of solidarity and what kind of efforts you want from the rest of the world, can you articulate that a little bit?
I wanted to be clear that there shouldn't be any double standards. Human rights is something that is global. It belongs to everyone. It's a human thing, okay? So there shouldn't be any double standards. It is very clear, for example, when Western governments take a lenient stance to what's happening in Bahrain, for example. It's very easy for any other dictatorship to start going into similar behavior, thinking that they can bargain for things, whatever they are. This general adoption of double standards. Some countries deserve to have human rights, the others don't. It depends on the idea, the concept of national security that until now we don't understand what it means. It's very vague and all this. Some people deserve democracy, but others have to wait. This is something that needs to end. The world needs to take a one stance. Everyone deserves to live in dignity. Everyone deserves to see accountability and deserves to live in democracy and to own their own future and lives. So if anything, the world needs to take that one stance.
Now, I think your mentioning of Bahrain is really important on that. Of course, the U.S. has whatever the fleet is, the 7th Fleet or something, sitting in the harbor in Bahrain. Hypocrisy on human rights with Bahrain has to do with the fact that our fleet is sitting in the harbor.
Yes. And Yemen also, many countries in the region have been betrayed by the solidarity of the world. When people watched Egyptians uprise, we've seen a shift in U.S. policy also. But also, we're not different than Yemenis and Bahrainis. We're still people. They're all people.
Right. Now, let me ask you, here, of course, there's been a lot of publicity in the United States about the charges against 16 Americans, against some Norwegians, some Germans, some others, but particularly around three organizations in the United States: National Democratic Institute, International Republican Institute, and Freedom House. And of course, one perspective is, why should the United States be having representatives of primarily the Republican Party and the Democratic Party in Egypt doing whatever they're doing? And I don't know what exactly they're doing, but I don't want to characterize Egyptians, but I think a lot of them might be suspicious about the U.S., particularly after it supported Mubarak for so long and plays a strange role in places like Bahrain. They'd be nervous about what NDI is doing, what IRI is doing. Do you have any thoughts about that?
It's easier to fool state media when it starts its campaign about agency and espionage and I don't know what, and all these organizations are coming to destroy the interests of Egypt to intervene in its sovereignty. Of course, the behavior of the U.S. and also the history of NDI and IRI, and generally speaking, it helps create a sense of, yes, they might be right, they might not be here for the right purpose. But again, Yani, I don't want to separate this attack from what's happening to everyone else, you know. It comes with a discourse that is against the freedom of association. It's coming with a proposal for a law that is much, much worse than the one that already exists. And it comes with also a discourse that says the human rights organizations are doing political activities. They're not doing nice development things like providing electric ovens for poor business owners in rural areas, for example. You know, so it's coming with a discourse that is trying to kill the sense of human rights organizations and human rights defenders can actually do something, are bad people, they're agents. They're recruited by the U.S., who knows who else. The next day, you know, the use of the word Bosnian, and that is something that has been used during the revolution when they were accused that revolutionaries were having trainings in Eastern Europe. It's a continuation of a crackdown over the concept itself that people need to fight for their human rights.
Now, I understand what you're saying, and I think it's a really important point, which is what makes the issue so difficult in a way, because here we in the United States, you know, we've been looking at NDI and IRI extremely suspiciously since they were founded in the 80s. I mean, they were involved, from what we understand, possibly in the Haiti coup in 2004, the IRI, efforts to get rid of Chavez in Venezuela, there's allegations. So these groups were not set up exactly for totally democratic reasons. And so we're looking at that, but I understand you're putting it in a broader context. But it does seem to me that they should just get out of there, NDI and IRI. I mean, they're just bringing the foot of the United States in. They're giving the Egyptian, whoever's deciding to go after them, a pretty good excuse for going after them. I know that's not in the context, but it's just saying what those groups represent, at least to progressives in the United States.
Oh, definitely, Yani. I agree that it is not, Egyptians overall does not want the U.S. to meddle around with Egyptian politics in that sense, and does not want to be too involved with what's happening. In this essence, I can totally agree with what you're saying, but at the same time, I'm too scared to go down this track because we don't want to generalize. Association needs to be respected regardless. Organizations need to be held accountable for any possible corruption or anything. There needs to be transparency. But also, there's nothing wrong with people understanding their rights. So there's nothing wrong with parties being trained to organize itself better. There's nothing, what's scaring, what is dangerous about these kind of activities. So I just don't want to go on down the track of having, I'm afraid to say, yes, Freedom House might be bad, NDI might be bad, IRI might be bad. This opens the door for everyone else.
I understand exactly what you're saying from a perspective in Egypt and democracy in Egypt. It's understandable. You're in the thick of the struggle. You have to figure out how to make it work for democracy in Egypt.
But of course, the Egyptian civil society needs to take the lead on what Egypt needs. There shouldn't be conditional funding of organizations. It is about what Egyptians feel they need, and any help on this is great and welcome, but Egyptians should take the lead on what they need.
In terms of hypocrisy of at least the United States on some of this, is, we have in the United States our own laws regarding organizations from overseas that work in the United States. And we have a foreign agent registration law. We have visa laws. We have all these kinds of things. And in some way, these organizations haven't complied with laws that if they were in the United States from a foreign country, they could be jailed for. So that's curious to me that on some level...
It's not their fault alone. It's not their fault alone. There's been, put aside NDI, IRI and Freedom House, let's look at other foreign organizations. Human Rights Watch, for example. Okay, they apply for registration. For how many years until now are they waiting for,
yes,
for the final approval from the government? So they keep, they never close these files. The government never closed this file, so it makes it easy for it to be able to interfere, kick out when it needs, prosecute if it feels like so, you know. So it is not only NDIIRI and Freedom House fault. It's something that's general with a lot of international organizations that exist in Egypt.
We're reading with great alarm, obviously, about what's happening in Egypt to democratic rights. How do you see the work unfolding over the next 6 months for your organization, for others?
And, I believe this crackdown will pass. There is determination amongst human rights defenders to continue. We have worked under difficult situations before. 30 years ago, it was in secret. So there's the people have risen, you know, and so I strongly believe that this will pass, and we will continue to struggle. Things are not looking very promising at the moment, but with determination and a strategic vision, I think things might get better at the end.
Sally Sammy, a human rights activist, talking to us from Cairo, Egypt. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Want to hear Law and Disorder again? Go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Law and Disorder has a wide geographical coverage in the United States. We have many, many affiliates. Today, we want to thank those affiliates. If you broadcast Law and Disorder and don't hear your name as an affiliate, please let us know. If you don't broadcast it, or you have a station that doesn't broadcast it, get them to and help us spread the word of Law and Disorder.
WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. KRFP. Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho. WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee.
KSOW Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP Clay, West Virginia. KRFC Fort Collins, Colorado.
WRCT Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. KWMD Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJ Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIF Enid, Oklahoma. 1640 AM, Front Royal, Virginia. WPVM, Asheville, North Carolina.
ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago, Oakland, Atlanta, Boston, Melbourne. Moton Community House Radio, online. WLRI, Gap, Pennsylvania.
WPRR, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS, Columbus Community Radio, Central Ohio. KKFI, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, California. WSLR, Sarasota, Florida. KDX, Internet Radio.
Lorain Community College Radio, Cleveland, Ohio. WHUS, Storrs, Connecticut. WJFF, Radio Catskill.
WDRT, Viroqua, Wisconsin. WERU, Bangor, Maine. KMUD, Oregon, Garberville, Eureka, Laytonville, Shelter Cove.
Voice of Sacramento, Sacramento Community Radio, Sacramento, California. WWPM, MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois.
Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR, Provincetown. And I'd like to send a special shout out to Provincetown since I grew up there every summer. WMHC, Mount Holyoke College in South Hadley, Mass. I'd also like to shout out to Mount Holyoke because I did 3 semesters there.
That's a record for Heidi.
Shut up.
KSER, Everett, Washington. WHUS, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington.
WCRS, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU, Illinois Central College in Peoria, Illinois.
WGCX, Community Radio, Green and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, Southbridge, Massachusetts. Thank you all. Thank you.